One of the ways we can think about contemplative practice and healing practice is that the contemplative lineages recognize something about the nature of attention that we could at different times call mindfulness or awareness, and recognize in a particular way how important or singular attention is among the mental faculties. And so we can, if we orient toward it, we start to have a framework for understanding of the relationship between, say, meditation and healing and, you know, training the mind in some ways, resisting the forces of harm in this world. So attention, this quality that's so central to mindfulness, to meditation, we can think of as the aspect of our ongoing experience where we are attending to or present with or in a certain way in contact with some aspect of our experience. And that aspect of our experience is going to be either physical and sensory, like if I'm paying attention, I might see you. So I might be connected to the visual sense and really observing or connecting with changes in the visual field. I could be paying attention to, like if you're paying attention, paying. We'll just put that in quotation. Paying. If you're giving your attention, let's say to what I'm saying here, you might be paying attention, you know, through the oral or auditory channel, as well as the visual. If you pay attention to your body and sensations, that's often what we call embodied attention or awareness. And I could give attention, say, to, you know, a sensation in my wrist or in the low back or the general sense of the whole body or the sensations of the breath. Anything you can notice, you can give your attention to. But attention can be both directed or volitional, like you can pay attention to something on purpose, and it can also be undirected, kind of going instinctually wherever it goes. And so I want to talk about attention in a so for these nice entrepreneurs, I made a graph thinking that they would like that. And the graph has on the x-axis volition. So from, this is a spectrum then of like not trying to do anything particular all the way to like really trying to specifically do something. So, you know, I could think of volition, let's say, in my garden might be the spectrum between just letting it grow wild and letting whatever seeds blow in on the wind or are volunteers there from previous gardens or, you know, get thrown out of a passing car as a piece of, you know, like an apple core gets thrown out and then an apple tree grows someday. Like non-volitional gardening. We'll make this a type of gardening, right? I just let grow what grows. And then, you know, all the way at the other end of the spectrum of volition would be like, you know, planting specific crops in tidy rows and weeding out the weeds and really sculpting what grows and really trying to kind of get it to do a specific thing. And then all the way along that spectrum, there's lots of different ways that one could essentially act more or less volitionally. You know, like I might we have a plot in a community garden near our house, and there's in our particular little rectangle amid all the other rectangles in the community garden, there were lots of weeds, of course, when we started. We pulled up the particularly gnarly weeds, but we left the dandelions because we like dandelion greens, even though we didn't plant them, but they're not. You can eat the leaves and they're lovely. And we left a couple other plants that were volunteers, but that we just liked, like borage, which has these cute little purple flowers that you can eat. So our garden bed has some combination of volitional, like a nice little row of lettuces, and then non-volitional. There's a volunteer mint and the volunteer borage and the and we kind of, you know, we tend it or we garden in a way somewhere on the volition spectrum, not trying to completely be controlling, but not completely going wild. So the x-axis of volition describes, if we're talking about attention, a range of ways we could use our attention. And in meditation practice, this is often a way to talk about two of the primary different types of meditation. One that we could call concentration or immersion. I like to just call it focus. And the Buddhist words would be samatha in Pali or shamatha in Sanskrit, samadhi, the unification of mind. So this is on the volitional side. And this is the, like, I'm going to train the mind to focus and settle and be steady on one thing. So if you're doing a meditation where you're tracking the breath, you're feeling the in and out breath, and you're really trying to stay with it and not let the mind wander. And when the mind wanders, you bring it right back. You're really training in steadiness. You're applying a fair amount of volition, right? The mind gets pulled away. You start to think about something else that's happening. And you say, kindly, hopefully, not now. And you come right back. And the training is then to learn in a kind of embodied way what it feels like for the mind or for the attention to be quite steady. So you keep weeding the garden, you weed it, and you weed it, and you weed it, and you weed it, ideally in a sort of organic way, just saying. And eventually, it's both easier to keep tidy, and not so many weeds grow back, especially if you weed the weeds at the right time in their life cycle so they don't bolt and put seeds down. Eventually, it's a fairly tidy garden. So you can do this with your mind. This is a volitional side. And one of the nice things about the volitional side of things is that it's volitional, meaning you're doing it on purpose, but you don't have to do it on purpose forever. In a certain way, once the garden is quite established, it takes quite a bit less effort to keep it tidy. You still have to stay with it. You know, if we leave town for a year, we would come back and it would be overgrown. But once it's a tidy garden, we could leave town for a few weeks and come back, and it would be pretty easy to clean up again. So in the same way with your mind, some amount of volitional practice, like learning to concentrate, in the beginning it's tremendously difficult, and the mind is just swept away all the time. But after a while, and what that really means is you get to know yourself, you get to know the states, you learn all the weeds, basically. And you learn, you know, how to weed. Like there's those gnarly grasses that put out these long tendrils. And if you just try to pick them, they just break off. And that does nothing because they have this tremendous root. But if you really dig it out, you get this taproot that can be like a foot long. Then you uproot it and it really comes out. And that was one of the early metaphors in the yogic systems for the purification of the heart. It's like, you know, you don't just sort of trim off the leaves at the top of the weed, you know, the weed of greed, hatred, and delusion, basically. But you try to uproot it. And the true uprooting, where it no longer grows back, is liberation, from that quality, from that weed. So the volitional side of the spectrum takes some effort, but eventually you can really relax into it and you get good at stillness. Right? Once you have some facility in the gathering and regathering of your attention, it actually rests there much more easily. And then it can be, you know, as simple as, like nowadays, our garden's in a pretty good shape this fall. So now when we go there, you know, I kind of just look around. You know, maybe I sort of scooch the hoe around for like 3 minutes, scrubbing up a tiny bit of clover that has returned. But basically, I just stand around, give it a little water, and then just nowadays, it's basically like eat tomatoes and raspberries. You know, I'm just like, yay, the garden's doing great. Just stand there eating things. That's a pleasure. It can be like that with your meditation. You come back to the sitting. You've been sitting regularly. You've been really practicing, concentrating. And like, yeah, your mind is spinning a little bit, but you really know, your body knows what stillness is like. And your mind knows what stillness is like. And then it can just be like, oh. And you know how to hook in to steadiness. It's very, very lovely. And deeply nourishing, really a restorative posture for the mind. So that's one style of meditation, the kind of the focus style. The other style, at the other end of the volition spectrum, is not an untended mind, like we would say an untended garden, but it's more like a kind of wild or permaculture style of gardening, where you are cultivating clear awareness of everything that comes through, but you're not being as choosy. I'm letting California wild native grasses grow and letting volunteers grow. And like, oh, here's a volunteer mint. Let it go. Let it grow. You know? And maybe here's a whole bunch of, let's say, you know, stinging nettle, which is really quite a lovely plant and makes a fabulous tea that's good for all sorts of things. Except that if you brush up against it, or your poor two-year-old brushes up against it, it's tremendously painful. And it stings for a while. Has anyone been stung by stinging nettle? Do you know what that feels like? Mm-hmm. It's just like, yeah, was that a yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like hot, itchy, burning stingingness. You brush up against its little leaves or stems. And it doesn't go away for a while. And you can't pluck them out. There's tiny, tiny little fierce plant defenders. But if you pluck them off just right, you've got these pokey leaves. You drop them in, you know, boiling water for an instant, they wilt. Those stingers immediately go away. And then you can eat them like greens or make tea out of them. Super awesome. So in a somewhat more open or wild system, I would just let that grow. Be like, yeah, okay, some nettles. I might still pull up, you know, a really gnarly weed that's like I'm not going to let poison oak grow, let's say. Even though I'm Californian, it is part of my home ecosystem. But, you know, if it appeared in the garden, I would pull it up. So in meditation, we can think of this as the practices that are more like open awareness. And pure vipassana in a certain way is like this, where I'm not trying to focus or concentrate my mind. I'm actually hanging back. And my intention is just to allow, in a non-grasping, non-resisting way, the flow of sensory experience. The reason it's a meditation and not just the mind-wandering is that the requirement is that you know it, that you recognize it. That's the other axis. So we'll get there in a second. So open awareness practices are more like, don't try to hold on to the breath or posture or anything, but just rest at ease and see what comes through. And then it might be, here's the breath. Now I'm sensing the pressure under my seat. Now I'm feeling movement. Now I'm hearing the hiss of sound outside the door. Now I'm feeling the quality in my mouth. Now I'm having a thought about my child. Now I'm hearing a sound. Now a larger breath is coming and an out breath, and I notice that that's pleasurable. And I notice movement. And it just goes on like this. And if you start to track in this way, this is just the constant flow of experience being met with attention. So our attention is always connecting to something. Let's say, except when we're in deep dreamless sleep. And even that you can train in. But for most of us, let's say we're not attending to anything in that state. But all the rest of the time, including in dreams, including when the mind's wandering, the attention is somewhere. And we could train in noticing that. In the way that, like, okay, I'm really lost in thought about something. I'm really, like, I'm, while we were sitting today, I was partly really just blissing out on deep stillness, and then I was partly thinking about this website update that I'm doing and whether we should go with this platform or that platform for this particular thing, and I thought about that a little bit, and then I noticed it, and I was like, oh, and I'm thinking about that, and I got the flavor of that thought world. It's like, oh, that's thoughts about that. And so if I'm doing a more focused style of meditation, which is usually my intention, as it was tonight, I noticed that and I said, okay, we'll think about that later. Set it down. Come back to the breath. And I came back to my breath and set it aside. But in a more like open awareness style of practice, I might say, oh, thinking, planning, and kind of let the thought roll for a little while. Be like, yeah, this is thinking. One of the beauties of open awareness kinds of meditation is that when you notice something, like a wandering thought, it still doesn't tend to stick around very long. Because noticing something automatically means you're unhooked from it a little bit. Even if what you're noticing is like, oh, I'm tremendously like there's so much restlessness, or I'm so worked up about something, I'm upset. As soon as you notice and you could say, I'm upset, you're automatically not quite as upset. Because if you were still more upset, you wouldn't have, it's almost like you wouldn't have that little tiny bit of your attention to spare to label it. If you can label it and say, oh, look, I'm totally upset. You know, every once in a while, I'll be going through my day. And, you know, if I'm in a more sort of fragmented or difficult space, I'm kind of freaking out. I'm getting all anxious about things. I'll just pause. Because it's my practice to pause whenever I can. And I'll be like, what's happening? And sometimes I'll just label it and I'll be like, I'm freaking out. I'm just totally freaking out. I'm anxious. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. And it's so helpful just to say it. I'll stop and say to me, and I'd be like, oh, I'm totally freaking out. And I'm resisting it. I'm trying to pretend that I'm still getting work done, but actually I'm just freaking out. So what should I do now? And so this is the place where the open awareness practice matures, is you notice quicker what's happening, especially if it's the difficult stuff. And you get to ask the question, given that this is happening, what's the right thing to do? And it might be like, you know, shake it off and keep working. Or it might be like, you know, get up from the screen, run around the block 5 times and drink some water. It's usually a good plan. It might be just go lie down on the living room floor, you know, or in a meadow if you happen to have one, and like just drop it and space out and lose it and freak out on the floor until you kind of emerge from whatever it is. And it could be any number of things. But the thing that open awareness practice gives you is an ability to be with the moving around mind and to really know, oh, this is where it's at right now, and this is where it's at right now. Because even to say like, oh, I'm freaking out, like, oh, go lie on the ground for a minute. So I go lay down and I might be like, oh, that's nicer. Like maybe there's still some kind of spin, but even just the act of laying down changed the whole thing. and the body, my body relaxes. It's almost even like I just acknowledge that I'm freaking out rather than being in the freak out. And so suddenly it's like, oh, that's workable. Right? Like soldiers are not knocking at the door right in this moment. Actually, I'm safe. I'm just worried about the website update. Like, it's okay. It actually doesn't matter in a large way. So the volition spectrum says two kinds of practice. One is to let everything flow, but be with it in an intimate way, observing. And the other is to narrow your focus within the flow and really steady your attention on one thing for a while, to sustain that attention there. So then we can move around on that spectrum as feels right for our process. So that's the x-axis of this, of my grid for the entrepreneurs. The y-axis is awareness or consciousness. This is a way of saying that some of the things that move through my attention, I'm conscious of in a kind of, I have that little bit of distance. I could tell you what's happening. I'm aware of my breath. I'm aware of thinking about business. I'm aware of seeing you, whatever that is. And then there's a threshold below which it's what we could call like unconscious material. And so this is when like I'm acting based on habit, or I'm dreaming, or I'm lost in an emotional or energetic state that's one of the trauma states, like I'm really lost in kind of a freezy or a fight and flight kind of state. And so the way the axes work is like this. If the volition axis goes from less volition on the left to more volition on the right, and the awareness axis goes from unaware at the bottom to very aware at the top, then there's four kinds of attention. I'm trying to say this backwards. So here's the quadrants. The upper right is where there's more volition and more awareness. This is conscious directed. So I'm conscious of what's happening and I'm directing it. I'm aware of the breath and I'm intending to stay there. So all of the focus meditations happen in that quadrant, the upper right. Directed and conscious. The upper left is the open awareness meditations, vipassana. And this is conscious but undirected. Less volition, but just as conscious. So I'm aware of what's happening, but I'm not guiding it as much. So conscious directed, conscious undirected. So then the lower left is unconscious undirected. So the mind is wandering, doing whatever, and I'm not really aware of it. This is mostly where the deep hindrances and what I'll think of as like, you know, traumatic states are. This is also where dreaming is, you know, where like I don't really know that I'm dreaming. This is non-lucid dreaming. And by the way, lucid dreaming would be upper left, right? It would be conscious undirected, probably. If I wake up in a dream, I'm like, oh, I'm dreaming. I'm aware that I'm dreaming. It's still kind of unfolding. If I'm dreaming and I actually start intervening, being like, when I was doing lucid dreaming practice, one of my main triggers for knowing that I was dreaming was, I had a few sort of things that I could notice in a dream that would tell me that I was dreaming. And the main thing I practiced doing was flying, because, you know, fly. So I'd be like, oh, I'm dreaming. That means I can fly. Therefore, if I can fly, that really means I'm dreaming. So I would jump and see if I could float through the air. I could never fly fast. I sort of flew kind of like a hot air balloon. So I was going to drift through the sky. But that was my lucid dreaming thing. I'm like, oh, I'm dreaming. Let's fly. So if you can do that, then you shift over to conscious directed, right? Because you're actually doing it. So dreaming could be either. But lower left, unconscious, undirected, is that material that is coming through on its own. It's undirected. And you don't really notice it. So this is when, like, I'm reactive to something. I'm feeling defensive or scared or shut down. And I'm not really aware of it. It's kind of governing my actions in a way. Mind is scattered. And from this state, unconscious, undirected, the way out is the way out in general of both of the unconscious realms, right, is to get more conscious. And it almost doesn't matter which direction you go. Generally, like from unconscious, undirected, you'll first come into conscious, undirected, right? I'll be like, I'll wake up in the middle of some trauma state. I'll be like, oh, I'm totally freezing out. But as soon as you notice, you go back over that threshold into conscious. Now you're doing kind of an open awareness practice. Yeah. Oh, I'm noticing that I'm shut down or frozen rather than it just governing me. So I bring consciousness to that if I can. And even that, if I can, that's not actually accurate because we're not up in the volition side. I'm making gestures in all the wrong corners for you. I apologize. I keep trying to think of it as backwards. This is really mysterious in meditation practice because the teaching is when the mind wanders, bring it back, right? But when the mind's wandering, by definition, you're not in control of it. Because if you're in control of it, you wouldn't be thinking about that, you know, TV show while you're sitting here trying to meditate. So if you could volitionally bring the mind back, you would have a long time ago. So then how does it work that the mind comes back when it wanders? Right? It's like mindfulness has disappeared. The volition part of mindfulness has disappeared. And then it just comes back on its own. Like you notice the mind is wandering. And it's basically that your intention, your volition in practicing meditation reappears. You forget and then you remember. And the remembering happens by itself. And so then the training in meditation is actually just to do that so many times that it happens quicker on its own. But you don't do it, right? Again, you can't do it. Hopefully hearing this absolves you of all guilt you might have for not being a good meditator, if you have that story that I have certainly had. And I've certainly, you know, been like, okay, in this meditation, I'm going to catch the wandering mind quicker. And that's a good thing to intend, but it's a kind of intention that is also kind of mysterious because you can't do it on purpose. But making the intention helps. This is part of how intention practice works. You know, you just say, may I notice the distraction sooner? What that really means is, may I notice distraction? And so you're saying, when the mind is unconscious, may that itself be a trigger for consciousness to arise, for mindfulness to return or to remember. So lower left is unconscious, undirected, and the pathway out is to become conscious of it. So that means we train in noticing the symptoms, basically, of fight, flight, and freeze. We notice, oh, frustration. I was lost in being angry. Or I notice anxiety. Oh, this is anxiety. I'm lost in it. Or this is shut down, all of that. Or this is a dream. And that becomes a very deep practice within Buddhism, is to notice dreaming. So all of that says, make the unconscious conscious. The other quadrant, the lower right, unconscious but volitional, is where I put things where there is a quality of experience being guided. But it's not being guided consciously. So here's where I put habit and like deep conditioning. You know, this is where like I'm not really thinking while I set the table, but I put the smaller fork on the outside of the bigger fork, right? Like, oh, I was trained to do that because I worked in this restaurant and I just do that now. I never think about it, you know, or like whatever. We have all of our habits, right? And here's where, for instance, like all the little obsessive things, if you have a kind of obsessive nature to you, this is where also, for instance, a lot of the addictions lie. Right? There is actually a will to return to a certain action over and over, but it's unconscious. Something's driving me. This is also where you could put like hypnosis. And the very deep side of this, you could put like spirit possession. Like something's driving the bus, but it's not me. So the most common aspects of this are like, you know, when you notice like, oh my God, I just drove all the way across town, but I don't even remember doing it. I was so lost in something else. But the habitual sequence called, you know, turn the car on, put this on, put the radio on, turn it on, do this, do a signal, like drive, even the habit called drive safely could be operating unconsciously. And again, habit is to be challenged because habit generally reinforces, habit doesn't often reinforce the positive without training. Eventually you can train, you can retrain habits. You want to retrain habits. You want to have the habit of returning the mind, you know, mindfully to a chosen object, for instance. But again, the main antidote is to make the unconscious conscious, to really notice, oh, I'm doing that. I'm in that habit again. Like, you know, like I'm emotionally upset, so I'm eating. But it's happening unconsciously, you know. I just sort of, mindfulness returned in the moment of standing with the refrigerator door open. I'm like, what am I doing here? I'm not hungry. Close it. What's actually happening? So, for both of the bottom quadrants, where awareness is weak, the process is to become conscious. And then on the consciousness side, open awareness or focus is actually your choice. And that becomes really just what's going to be most wholesome for your practice right now. Is it going to be more wholesome to focus in or to take a wide lens? So in a way, the volition spectrum is also the spectrum of action, skillful action. What's the right action to take? And the awareness spectrum is, in a certain way, just goes from, is a spectrum essentially of increasing, like power or appropriateness. Like more consciousness is generally always better, but more or less volition could be fine. So there's a, what's the word, like, the awareness spectrum is like, more is better. So that's our kind of qualitative, or that's our quantitative spectrum. And the volition spectrum is more qualitative. It's different qualities that could both be. They could be wholesome in either side or unwholesome in either side. So to finish up, and then I'm curious to hear what you think about this as a framework. One of the things that's been helpful for me in thinking this way is that it doesn't make any particular part of it wrong, but simply identifies in a way like what's happening when I'm lost in this painful state. It's like, oh, there's not as much awareness or as much volition as I would prefer. Really, generally, it's that there's not as much awareness. And it really highlights then the importance of the core quality of mindfulness for everything else in the training. And then this just becomes a way that as I move through my day, I can ask myself the question, like, oh, what's happening? Oh, I was lost in a habit, or I was lost in a painful state, or I was just chilling out, letting things happen however they happen. Or I'm really working on something. I'm focusing on some task. And so this is a framework for the training of attention. So any thoughts or responses here? Any questions on this as a framework?
Doesn't it take a certain amount of volition to become aware, though? And to get in confused?
To become aware.
Or to decide to be more aware. Like, wouldn't that take...
This gets funny in language. So, certainly it takes volition to, like, to want to be on the path of increasing awareness, right? So for me to say, may I train in increasing awareness, that's mm-hmm. volitional. But I think what you're asking is, like, in the moment of, let's say, going from a lost, distracted mind state to being conscious of what's happening,
mm-hmm.
is there volition in the arising of mindfulness?
Yeah.
Yeah. In a technical kind of early Buddhist framework, there is, because there's volition in everything, that in every kind of action, including mental movement. So, but volition and mindfulness are different mental qualities. This is part of the Abhidhamma. It's super kind of precise parsing out of lots of different qualities, right? So this gets a little analytical, abstract. But the sense would be something like in the moment of mindfulness returning, there's going to be a bunch of different qualities present. Mindfulness is just one of them. That's the kind of the noticing quality or the remembering quality. Then there could be a volition quality that could be something like, now there's the reconnecting with like the breath or with an image or with a sound or whatever. And so mindfulness notices and then volition directs. Mm. So I notice, oh, there's anger happening. Mm. And then volition says, even if mindfulness says there is anger happening, the volition says, look at the anger. Right? So there's a noticing and then there's a directing of attention that has volition to it. And then there's going to be a bunch of other things. Like there's going to be an assessment quality, wise effort mm-hmm. might be there, where you're like, is this a quality worth uplifting or diminishing? Mm-hmm. And so then there's a kind of judging quality that's sometimes called sampajana or full awareness. So you not only notice that there's a state, but you attend to it, and then you understand it in a way. And there's a few others. So you can look up the charts that say, you know, in this mind moment, there's these 7 qualities or these 18 qualities or these 20. Yeah. But I think maybe I'll ask, like, say a little more about what feels like is behind the question, mm-hmm. practice-wise. Like, what's useful about that? For me, when I hear it, what I wonder is if the question is something like one that arises for me a lot, which I could almost boil down to like, how hard should I work at this?
Right.
Right. Like, how much do I have to try?
Right.
And how much kind of happens on its own?
Right.
Is that in there?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. This is really different in different lineages. So, you know, there are some lineages, some yogic lineages, where intense effort is really emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started my practice in a Zen lineage that said things like you should hold this core, like, great doubt. Like, don't believe anything. Hold the great question of life and death, of birth and death. And it should be like a red hot iron ball in your throat that you can neither swallow down nor spit up. You're stuck with it until you solve it. Seriously. It's very, very, we might say, masculine or kind of warrior style tradition in its energy. And then, you know, much later on, I practiced in traditions like Tibetan Dzogchen a little bit, or aspects of the Thai forest tradition more, that are like this, that would say things like, everything already is expressing its nature. Nothing needs to be interfered with. All you need to do is allow yourself to rest as fully as you can into things as they are. Nothing needs to be changed. Things already express their Buddha nature, their luminous, clear nature. So there's a story from the Zen tradition that paradoxically it can hold both of those, both the fierce effort part and the letting go completely part. There's a story about a monk, two monks. One monk is sitting there like really meditating, concentrating, like really, you know, strong posture, hours and hours meditating. And his fellow monk, who in this story is the wiser one, comes along and says, "What are you doing?" And the monk applying fierce effort says, "You know, I'm becoming a Buddha." The other monk goes, picks up an old roof tile, it says, it's nearby, and starts rubbing it fiercely, rubbing the tile. And the meditating monk goes, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm making a mirror." The sitting monk immediately is enlightened, realizes. What does he realize, right? What he realizes, in a way that the commentary tells us, what he realizes is that just as you can't make a tile into a mirror by polishing it, so you can't make an enlightened being by struggling as an unenlightened being. Like, you can't train yourself toward the unconditioned or toward liberation. Liberation is not the result of training, is what it says, really. It's a state that's already, always already available right here. So both of those things exist in the traditions. But then it can be confusing, because if you heard the teaching, everything's already perfect just as it is, you might, and some people do, have this response that in a certain way says, well, then I don't need to do anything, do I? Like, I don't need to practice. Practice is hard. Why would you do a hard practice if everything is already perfect? The other side of that is, and the mystery of that, you have to flesh out then. You have to say, well, you know, the great San Francisco Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi, said it like this. He said, look, you're perfect just as you are. And you could use some work. You have to wait just the right little pause between those two phrases to let it really sink in. There's this way that, like, yeah, everything is already expressing its nature, including your defilements, including the great pains. Why then is it so difficult to rest into ease? If everything is already just the way it is, like, why aren't we just at ease? It's like, yeah, there's suffering in the world. People are greedy and hateful. So you respond the best you can. You know? Why is that so hard? And the teachers would say, well, it's hard because there's grasping. Grasping is also already perfect just as it is. But then here's some sort of paradox, right? Like, If I start to accept everything just as it is, including grasping, grasping decreases, because acceptance and grasping are opposites. So if everything is already perfect, why would I grasp at getting this thing that I really want? I could go for it, you know. I really like a nice cup of tea. I could go for a nice cup of tea. But I don't really like the feeling of being parched. But if I wasn't resisting the feeling of being parched, I might not need to go for the tea. So in a certain way, if I start to accept everything as it is, I could both continue doing all the things I do. And this is a doorway toward non-blame, non-judgment. There's no sin in this system. But it's also a doorway toward a profound renunciation, because if I'm actually content, then there's not actually that much to do. Right? You eat a little food, take care of your people. It gets pretty uncomplicated once grasping starts to slip away. So this is kind of like the paradox at the heart of practice. How much do you actually try? You know, this is a question about purification, really. Like, you have to practice, but then for what? I think it's made more difficult in our culture here because, for a lot of reasons, one of which is that we are exposed to many, many very different teachings. And so one night you could hear somebody say, like, really, weed your garden. You got to do it. Don't let your mind be overtaken by greed and hatred and delusion. Like, the world needs you to do that, to respond with more wisdom. And the next night you could go to hear someone say, accept everything just as it is. And that can be really confusing. They might just be instructions for different points along a long spiritual path. So.
I think it's a great compass, what you presented with Rav. We can never get lost.
As far as I can tell, everything is on there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think compass is a nice word for it, right? Mostly, as with a lot of these teachings, I want it to be a thing that once we plant it in our minds shows up to be orienting in times when we might feel lost. Like, oh no, I'm totally freezing out. I'm overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, oh, this is the overwhelmed state. I know that state. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can choose where we want to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless we notice.
Yeah. And it's really first notice, then choose. Because if you're not noticing, then your choices are going to be all unconscious, and then you're down in the lower right. Yeah. Right? You're not noticing, but you're choosing. Yes. You're just going back for the chocolate. Right. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, chocolate is intrinsically pure in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But notice. So come up on the awareness spectrum, and then the choice is yours. You know, mm-hmm. Come lay back, lean in, whatever feels right.
Yep.
Yeah.
I tell my husband, pay attention to what you pay attention. That's sums it up.
Yeah, totally, totally, mm-hmm. Totally. So much of this work is really that your attention is your most precious resource. Mm-hmm. And really, you can only, one of the corollaries to this is you can only pay attention to one thing at a time, right? You can't actually multitask. You can move quickly between things. That's what multitasking is. But you can only give attention to one thing at a time, which means attention is finite. There's only so much of it in a given day. Mm-hmm. And so every minute that the advertisers have your attention is a minute that something else doesn't. You know, so
absolutely.
That's why it's the thing that everybody's paying for right now. Why is everything so expensive? Because advertisers are paying for your attention constantly.
Oh, yeah.
That's the main thing they want, mm-hmm. Right? Is they want you to, you know, they want you to spend longer on the website. They want you to spend more time watching without clicking. If you're listening to like the internet radio station Pandora, and you haven't done anything for a while, like you haven't interacted with it, you haven't said you like or dislike something or whatever, it's just playing, it'll stop after a little while and it says, hey, are you still there? It sounds like we might be playing to an empty room, and we don't like that. What they're really saying is, have we lost your attention? We want it back. And I think some of the strongest interventions we can do now are to put boundaries on our attention, to actually say, I will not give my attention to this and this and this. Just like back off. The classical metaphor for this is a horse that with blinders. Like if a horse just sees things off the path, it just will go for them. So the mind will do that. I have a great productivity app on my computer. It's called Self-Control. But it's not really self-control. It's actually the app for when you don't have self-control. It's basically a blacklist. And on it, for me anyway, there is Facebook and then all of the news sites that I obsessively read. So Facebook and the New York Times and the Guardian from London and you know, the New Yorker and the Atlantic and the Nation, you know, my center-left news sources, that if I get distracted on my workday, I might very easily be tempted to jump over to and give my attention to. So what this little app does is it makes it, you put a timer, and it just makes it impossible for you to open them, even if you uninstall the app and restart your computer. It just stops you. And it's this great admission that you're basically addicted, you know.
Well, you're on the unconscious.
That's on the volitional. Unconscious volitional, right? Habit is driving me. Right, I space out a tiny bit, and then boom, I'm scrolling on Facebook. I was like, stop.
There's so much suffering. Yeah.
There's so much suffering. So partly what it does is it, you know, it makes it impossible to go with that addiction, but it also becomes an awareness thing, because once it's on, I notice the impulse to go to it. It's like, oh, wait, it's been an hour. What if something has happened? Maybe I should check the times. Right? What if the president tweeted something and we're at war now? Like, I gotta know. So then it, you know, it stops you, but what it really does is it makes it conscious.
It does?
Yeah.
Before you throw the laptop out the window.
Totally. Because it's like, well, that won't help, you know. What you do is you end up noticing the impulse. And over time, the training is just to notice the impulse and to redirect.
Yeah.
To redirect it. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you said resonates for me was that the 2 years that I've been conditioning myself to the habit of sitting and having a timer, is that is what you were saying in two aspects of it that resonates. One is that in order for us to come to that place of spaciousness, we have to uncondition ourselves from all the conditioning that we've been inheriting or training or practicing or being, trained to be on in order for us to come to this enlightenment where we can just feel complete with what it is. It's one thing that resonates very well. And then the other thing that resonates for me is that when I don't have the opportunity to adhere to the practice of sitting, I find myself still enjoying the fruit of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you said with the gardening, that you don't have to work too hard.
Yeah.
That same thing starts to make its way in my own routines, even in those occasions where I skip the practice.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was straight shooter.
Right on.
It was really... appealing. Thank you.
Excellent. You're so welcome. Really, may it be the case that, like, you know, a life of practice doesn't mean just sitting every day forever, unless that's pleasurable, and ultimately that it just becomes this very sweet, pleasurable thing to sit, but that it really becomes a training that throughout the day, throughout, there's just, you know, the word Buddha means awake. Just means like just wakeful, you know. I just know what's happening. Right on. So I'll let you know how it goes, the glampers, and we'll see you next week. So, as always, our group is sustained on the practice of gift economy. So your generosity keeps the circle happening. Thank you for your generosity, and. Yeah, and coming up soon, maybe I had said we would start maybe in October, maybe we'll start in November, but we're going to do an experiment of kind of formalizing the topics that we'll look at kind of month by month and put out a little bit of promo for it to sort of say, like, this is what we'll look at in these times so we can plan ahead a little bit. So we're going to play with that a little bit going forward. So some of that may appear. Just take a moment as we close to just gather ourselves again. And from this gathered sense, then there's both the gratitude for being able to practice together and then the seed of intention going forward, that we just carry the practices of being awake and present on into everything that we do. So, may all be well.